Hello, everyone. Dan Delman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Today's program leads off with what we might call nostalgia. I was 7 years old when World War II began, and able to read right from the get-go when I went to school. So I was very much involved in reading the daily newspaper and looking at the maps of the different battle fronts during the war. And for 4.5 years, I've followed it closely. And so I thought today that this first item might be of interest to you who perhaps share my approximate age and remember back to things that happened in World War II. But what I wanted to talk about was what was happening before the war began. Usually we hear that we were totally unprepared when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and then we declared war on Germany too. But we were already in preparation. And it's that preparation that I'd like to talk about for a little while this morning. It's from the New York Times, a lengthy article from the book review section. And it's entitled, Building an Army from Scratch. How did America transform its military before World War II? Paul Dixon has written a book called The Rise of the GI Army, 1940 to 1941. And this book recounts the remarkable story of how the United States built its army from scratch before World War II. In 1939, the army comprised fewer than 200,000 poorly trained and equipped troops and officers. But by October 1941, the country's newly refurbished army had over 1.5 million soldiers in uniform and was led by a revitalized officer corps. Dixon's goal is to explain how this feat was accomplished before Americans knew that they were going to war. Paul Dixon's book reveals some little-known history about the Army and American society in the 1930s and the early 1940s. And some readers may be surprised to learn that a New Deal program, the Civilian Conservation Corps, known as the Tree Army, was run by the Department of War. The men that were recruited for the CCC never received military training, but Army officers supervised their camps, which ran with military efficiency. The Army learned valuable lessons from this experience, including how to manage a large influx of recruits. Many of the Tree Army's leaders later become non-commissioned officers in the service. The experience also demonstrated to the Army Chief of Staff, General George C. Marshall, the virtues and the potential of a citizen force. Also pivotal in the making of this new army was the establishment of a peacetime draft in September of 1940. The legislation was fiercely opposed by many isolationist groups who were wary of being pulled into a European war. And its passage was a hard-fought victory for the draft's advocates. That political fight was then revisited a year later when it was time to extend the draft's initial 12-month term of service. In Dixon's telling, the peacetime draft was essential to readying the Army for war. And without it, the United States and its allies' experience in World War II would never have been, it would have been dramatically different. And our outcome would probably not have been the same. And many more lives would have been lost. Also, major sections of this book discuss a series of maneuvers in the American South in 1940 and 1941, including the important Louisiana maneuvers of 1941. And these involved hundreds of thousands of men. The exercises allowed the growing army to test new formations and their equipment, and to expose its soldiers to the drudgery and the physical challenges of deployment under difficult conditions. Among the most important lessons learned by the military leadership was how to move and how to supply large numbers of men. General Marshall plays an especially important role in Dixon's story, as someone who both understood and who embraced the effort to expand the Army through draftees. Under Marshall's leadership, the Army established basic training for all new soldiers. Marshall also pushed for the creation of officer candidate schools, which enabled the best of the Army's enlisted personnel to become officers. During the war, the schools generated more than 150,000 officers a year. Marshall's keen appreciation for his soldiers' well-being also inspired the creation of the Morale Division to provide the men entertainment and spiritual sustenance. Under Marshall's watch, the USO was established in February 1941, bringing movie stars like Bob Hope to military audiences around the country. And then, meritocracy is also a persistent theme, especially in the tactics Marshall employed to ensure that only worthy officers would lead the troops. In the course of the maneuvers, over 1,000 officers were fired or reassigned. The first significant officer to go was a major general who was the Army's senior division commander. Of the 42 corps and division commanders participating in the Louisiana maneuvers, 31 were removed. The press also contributed to building the new army, and not by accident. Journalists were prized guests at the maneuvers. At one time, the military provided a space with tables and typewriters that spanned three quarters of a city block. Marshall and others hoped that they would write stories that would both generate pride in the new army and encourage Americans to spend more to support it. Many of the journalists did just that. Marshall also relied on popular culture to seduce the public, as well as to encourage camaraderie in the ranks. He solicited help from Hollywood to make films, films about the Army's needs that would be shown in theaters around the country. In early 1941, the service disseminated a new field manual that included a glossary of military slang. including an entry for GI, or government issue. The narrative even includes a bit of celebrity. In July of 1941, General George S. Patton appeared on the cover of Life magazine, providing, as Dickinson puts it, a face for the new army. The book evokes the ethos of World War II era, with subtle notes of can-do attitude and pugnacious spirit. It also, in some measure, reinforces the mythology surrounding World War II's The Greatest Generation. Many Americans have come to believe that there was something intrinsically valorous about the generation that fought the Germans and the Japanese. Dickinson's narrative does very little to disabuse us of this, for these men indeed were better Americans. Our second item today is about climate modeling. There is an article in the October 7th issue last year in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly about climate anxieties. And the title of the article was, "Do the Models Match the Hype?" Well, this is a common adage among scientists and statisticians. All models are wrong, but some are useful. Well, with that in mind, that's certainly true in the modern world, where they're by nature mere shadows of real-world scenarios. Computer models serve as vital guideposts in some of humanity's most complex and dangerous pursuits, from skyscraper construction to air and space travel. In the world of climate science, models have come under particularly intense scrutiny, with some skeptics dismissing them entirely. At the same time, though, thousands of scientists are banking on these models as guideposts for the planet's future. What makes them so sure? Climate models encapsulate everything we know about how the world works. The equations that are their foundation are ones that we use over and over again and are interwoven into the fabric of our daily lives. If we didn't understand fluid dynamics, for example, we couldn't predict the weather. We wouldn't make pipe systems work. We could not make chemical plants work. None of the physics and climate models is really new. Still today, models are highly complex, and they take into account a multitude of processes that affect the climate. Uncertainty is part of their DNA. They offer a range of scenarios based on human actions, but there also is uncertainty in the forecasts that each model gives, and a difference in what the top models tell us. Take the most basic, long-term global temperature increase. A climate scientist at NASA notes that the models predict ranges of warming from 1.5 to 4.5 degrees Celsius, and that gap hasn't materially changed as models have gotten ever more sophisticated. But when you think of it, that's kind of bonkers. A degree and a half is not that bad. 4.5 degrees is totally catastrophic. Scientists worry that the scientific uncertainty can be misinterpreted by the broader public. there is uncertainty, but there is also really, really great certainty. We've ruled out fine. Fine is not going to happen. Differences among climate models help show the points where they agree and the elements we can really trust. And the range of results that they give helps us understand the risks of various actions. Uncertainty doesn't mean you should not take action because you don't know the outcome. It means you should be very cautious about the extremes happening because you can't rule them out. A lot of the confusion about models comes from a misunderstanding of what they are and what they aim to do. The models aren't theoretical worlds so much as simulated ones, constrained by laws of physics and chemistry, and constantly being validated against observations, recent history, and the deep past. Climate models aren't designed to predict specific weather or events, but they do predict the probability of weather patterns and weather extremes occurring. Now let's take a short break while you listen to some more music. And now, the world's greatest natural resource. In the August 31st edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, there was an editorial by the editor of the paper about the world's greatest natural resource. And for more than a century, prosperity has come from the ground in Wyoming. Since the Industrial Revolution, human economic progress has been disproportionately dependent on the black rocks that exist so tantalizingly near the surface in Wyoming, coal. So the people of the cowboy state have cashed in. For many, those rocks have been the path to a better life. But there's a problem. What happens when there aren't any rocks left? Or if people don't pay as much for them anymore. Or if you're from another state, what if you don't have any valuable rocks to begin with? Natural resources are fickle things. The race to get hold of them has fueled some of the worst moments in human history. Colonialism, after all, is in some respects the biography of rabid thirst for natural resources. And within a country, the desire to control natural resources can lead to gross corruption and to inequality. This year, for the first time, America will use more renewable energy than coal energy. As the earth signals urgent need to be more thoughtful about how we consume natural resources, it's a positive sign. Natural gas is cleaner than coal, and wind and solar energy are cleaner still. Progress isn't the word that many in Wyoming would use. Instead, it feels like this wide swath of the American West is losing its hope and its way of life. How are these two things to be reconciled? Well, in order to find out, you should read this issue of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly for August 31st, because the main article is about the problems in Wyoming, the declining importance of coal, and the increasing importance of the renewables. In fact, in this editorial that I'm reading to you, there's a picture of wind turbines spinning in Fort Bridger, Wyoming, on July the 4th this year. The state is using alternatives to coal, including renewable resources. It's time now for some questions and answers. Questions asked of the scientists at the Smithsonian Institution by readers of the magazine. The first one of these today is, I've heard lightning rarely strikes in the Arctic. Why so? The answer is that thunderstorms and resultant lightning, in order for that lightning to occur, there must be rising currents of warm, moist air. Deep in the Arctic and Antarctic, there is only cold, dry air, which does not rise and thus cannot form thunderclouds. But as climate change brings more moist and warmer air to the area, lightning is increasing and causing fires in the boreal forests where that used to be rare. Our second question of the day is, will climate change have any effect on all the space junk, like outdated satellites or spent rocket stages currently in orbit? Answer, when scientists discuss the greenhouse effect, they're usually talking about changes in the troposphere, which is the lowest part of the Earth's atmosphere. The thermosphere, where most of these man-made orbiting objects are located, is also experiencing an increase in carbon dioxide. But at that level, because the atmosphere is much less dense, carbon dioxide behaves differently. Instead of trapping heat, the carbon dioxide releases heat into space and chills the upper layer of the atmosphere. As a consequence, the thermosphere contracts, resulting in less atmospheric drag or friction on these orbiting objects or space junk. And now the last of the questions for today. Kind of a curious question. How does a coffee brand earn the label bird friendly? Coffee plants can be grown either in the understory of tree canopies, a practice that helps sustain migratory bird habitat, or in direct sunlight, which drives deforestation and leads to less diverse habitats. To conserve habitats from overwintering migratory bird populations, the Smithsonian's bird-friendly certification effort, started in the late 1990s, supports farmers who opt for shade-grown coffee. At the moment, 45 farms are participating in the program, and they are primarily in Central and South America. To be certified, the plantation must include forest land that has not been cut for at least 10 years and support 10 native tree species, provide 40% shade coverage, and also be USDA certified organic. And those are our questions and answers for this week. For those of you who are Martians or are interested in Martians, next week's program will be about Mars. In fact, the title to the first of our items next program will be A Mania for Mars. And I'll be asking the questions, who's going to Mars? What is so interesting about Mars? Which nation got there first? Have we found life on Mars? And when will humans go to Mars? And that brings up a final part of this presentation on Mars, the challenge of landing safely. Because landing a manned spacecraft on Mars will be extremely difficult. The planet's atmosphere is about 100 times thinner than the Earth. Thank you for listening today. Tune in next time. Be safe out there. Take care of yourself. Wear your mask. Social distance, please. That helps all of us. We'll get through this together. Come back for a little of this and a little of that.